Here Be Monsters is a show that invites you to explore fear and the unknown.
I saw her face change. I saw her see where I'd pulled my hair out.
Psychological warfare was always considered kind of an oddity, something done by freaks.
On the count of three, we're literally going to step out of our body. Step out.
You can find Here Be Monsters now at kcrw.com or wherever you get your podcasts.
From KCRW in Santa Monica and PRI, Public Radio International, this is To The Point.
How local cops are becoming tax collectors. Hello again, I'm Armin Alney with a special rebroadcast of To The Point. So-called zero-tolerance policing has been embraced as a way of reducing major crimes by focusing on minor ones. But there's another reason. Fines and fees for low-level violations are now major sources of revenue for cities that have reduced taxation. When poor people can't pay, they're assessed with penalties, often increased, until jails become debtors' prisons, especially for blacks and other minorities. That's led to anger, resentment, and sometimes violent confrontations with the police. We'll hear how backdoor municipal finance causes social chaos. Today's talking point, the Jewish con man who hustled Hitler. First, here's the news.
Check out KCRW's all-news channel, News 24. Programming from KCRW, NPR, the BBC, and more 24 hours a day. Go to kcrw.com/news24, or you can listen on KCRW's app. Support for To The Point comes from the members of KCRW and from the Public Radio International Program Fund.
Hello again, Marvin Alney back with this special rebroadcast of To The Point. Local police are acting as tax collectors in many American cities. That's putting municipal finance on the backs of the poor. We'll have a conversation about how that works. On our talking point later, does your family have a memoir just waiting to be told? You'll have a hard time topping Walter Shapiro, whose great-uncle hustled Hitler and live to tell the tale. First is news update. The summer recess is over. Congress returns tomorrow, and it has till the end of this month to complete a new spending plan. How likely is that with this year's election just a month later? Reed Wilson is national correspondent for The Hill. As always, welcome aboard.
Thanks for having me, Warren.
So there's a lot of unfinished business, but the fiscal year ends on September 30th. So how likely is it that Congress will make the deadline for the spending plan?
It's almost certain. Republicans and Democrats alike do not want to be going into an election year, just a month out from Election Day, with a government shutdown or some kind of big squabble over spending. So what we're hearing is both sides offering support, qualified at least, for a short-term spending plan that would punt us either into the lame duck session after the elections or into the 115th Congress, which convenes in January.
That's really interesting because, of course, the lame duck session will have the same people that are serving today, and the new one next year will have people who have been either reelected or replaced.
And that means that each side has even further incentives to push for their particular vision. Republicans are likely to lose seats in Congress this year just by nature of the fact that it's a presidential election year, and higher voter turnout in those years tends to be better for Democrats. Democrats are obviously going to want to push it into the 115th Congress when they're going to have not only more seats, but they might even have control of the U.S. Senate, given the outcomes of November's elections.
What are the chances that we might see a vote on President Obama's nomination for the U.S. Supreme Court?
Almost non-existent before Election Day. You've heard some Republicans lately changing their tune a little bit on whether or not Merrick Garland, President Obama's nominee, might get a vote in the lame duck session. Chuck Grassley, the senator from Iowa, who's the chairman of the Senate Judiciary Committee, has hinted at least that he's open to holding a vote. The calculus there is that Merrick Garland is relatively centrist. He's not a flaming liberal. And if Hillary Clinton becomes the president in 2017, then she very well may appoint somebody who would be more liberal than Merrick Garland would be.
Okay, so what are some of the other issues that the Congress might actually deal with in the next month?
Well, I think we're going to see further debate on the most contentious issue is going to be funding to fight the Zika virus. Both sides have made proposals to spend more money through the CDC or various other government health organizations to try to fight back a virus that is expanding around the country, especially down in Florida now that, that the cases have been multiplying there. We're also going to see some action on a bill that would allow the Veterans Administration to fire workers more easily. There have been some real scandals in the Veterans Administration in the last couple of years, whether it's cost overruns in the billions of dollars at facilities in places like Denver, or whistleblower cases in which it has been revealed that veterans have had to wait days, weeks, even months to get an appointment, and that's something that's probably cost lives.
Back to Zika, you said that's a controversial issue. What's controversial about trying to stop a disease that could affect a lot of people?
Well, just like a lot of other bills that happen or that come through Congress, it's not only a Zika funding bill. Democrats and Republicans are each going to try to attach their favored programs. The holdup lately has been some Republican-backed programs in the bill that would slash funding to Planned Parenthood, for example, and make some other changes that are unrelated to Zika. You know, a lot of times these must-pass bills become what we call Christmas trees, in which every legislator hangs his or her favorite program onto one of the branches.
Or it puts in a poison pill that might kill the tree.
That's exactly right. And that therein lies the debate between Republicans who want to do some other things along with Zika funding and Democrats who say, no, just keep funding the fight against the virus. The problem is going to get worse before it gets better. At the moment, the federal government is using funds that were originally earmarked to fight the Ebola outbreak in West Africa. And those funds are going to dry up pretty fast.
There will be in the neighborhood of 6 weeks until the next election. What are the issues that are major in the presidential campaigns and in other campaigns across the country that you think we'll hear a lot of noise about, even though there might not be any action?
I think we're going to hear a lot of noise about jobs and about taxes. Both sides are going to try to stake out their particular positions on jobs and taxes ahead of November's elections. The economy, even after 7 years of recovery, still remains voters' number one issue. The one issue that we're not going to hear about from congressional Republicans is the issue that Donald Trump has been talking most about, and that's immigration. You're not going to hear any kind of hardline immigration rhetoric because a lot of the Republicans, especially the senators, up in key states, are in states that have a huge Hispanic percentage of the vote, states like Florida, where Marco Rubio is running for re-election, or even up in Ohio and North Carolina, where Senators Rob Portman and Richard Burr are seeking a new term.
So they're trying to keep their heads down, given the fact that Trump has not softened his positions, as was once predicted.
Right. And Republicans are really trying. They say they're trying to run for sheriff. They're running on local issues. You know, Rob Portman in Ohio is talking a lot about the opioid epidemic in the Rust Belt states. They don't want to be running on big national issues because they think that in a lot of these swing states, Donald Trump is the big national issue that could be the albatross around their neck.
Reed Wilson with The Hill. Many thanks.
Thanks a lot, Warren.
In a moment, how local cops are becoming tax collectors on To the Point from PRI.
Select sessions from KCRW's music program Morning Becomes Eclectic can be experienced in the immersive world of virtual reality. Download KCRW's VR app to get lost in the music. Go to kcrw.com/VR.
KCRW thanks Factiva from Dow Jones for its use of Factiva.com.
Warren Olney back with To the Point. Criminal justice can be expensive, and since the late 1990s, state legislators have allowed cities and counties to increase their revenue by raising fines and fees. In combination with so-called broken windows policing, that's led to intense focus on minor crimes by the police, by prosecutors, and by the courts. Alexis Harris at the University of Washington has described the consequences in a book called A Pound of Flesh. Welcome to our program.
Thank you for having me.
Tell us, what are the consequences?
It's a great deal of consequences to the fines and fees. The obvious consequences are the financial. So people are put in a great deal of debt, and these tend to be people in general who make contact with the civil and criminal justice systems. They tend to be underemployed and unemployed and have mental health issues and drug and alcohol addiction issues. So even, you know, a $150 ticket or the $1,200, you know, average amount per felony conviction in Washington State is a great deal of financial debt for individuals. And on top of that, we have in Washington 12% interest, $100 annual collection fee. So it puts them in a cycle of debt. So one consequence is financial. Another is that it tethers people to the criminal justice system. If you aren't making regular payments or you're not making sufficient payments, warrants can be issued for your arrest. So you're constantly under the surveillance of the criminal justice system, under police, and can be brought back and incarcerated and spend up to $60 days in jail for non-payment. And then on top of that, there are the emotional consequences for individuals. People I interviewed are frustrated. They're disappointed with themselves. They're having to think about what their lives are going to look like in debt for the rest of their lives. They're seen as financial liabilities to their family and friends. And there's also sort of this sense of never being able to be sort of a full adult and live their lives regularly. So there's a great deal of consequences for individuals, and then we can also talk about consequences for the criminal justice system and for us as citizens to have to pay for this process as well.
Before we do that, be a little more specific, if you will, about how a $150 traffic fine turns into a lifetime of debt.
Right, so $150, if you're poor and unable to pay it or unemployed or homeless, is always going to be there. If you have a 12% interest that accrues on that, $100 annual collection charge, for many people who can't pay this, it will follow them around.
How much does it add up to?
I haven't calculated that for $150 with a 12%. I've done it on the average for what happens in Washington with interest, and I can tell you that it increases very, very quickly. In fact, people will get their regular monthly bill, and even when they're paying the minimum payment of $20 or $50, the bill will increase monthly and create a situation where they feel like they shouldn't even bother to pay it because they can't get out from under it.
If they end up in jail, doesn't that cost the state even more than if they had paid the fines?
Right. So we're paying for people to spend the night in jail or many nights in jail because that individual was unable to make a $50 or $20 a month payment. One study in Washington State estimated that on a given day in one county, up to 20% of the daily inmate population in county jails are there related to non-payment reasons. So of course it costs citizens, it costs us taxpayers, it costs the criminal justice system in terms of time, a lot of resources to have the system that is clearly not a fair punishment for poor people.
How does it make them feel about the police?
Right. It creates a system of where they sort of view the criminal justice system as illegitimate, right? It's this frustration of knowing that you're being policed essentially to generate fines and fees, ticky-tack fines and fees of what I've called before. And so you can understand what's happening in Ferguson and Baltimore and Milwaukee and other cities in part, you know, in addition to police contact that results in murders. In addition, you know that you're being policed for money, and so it really delegitimates the criminal justice system in people's eyes.
Alexis Harris, Associate Professor of Sociology at the University of Washington, author of A Pound of Flesh. Stephen Loomis is President of the Cleveland Patrolmen's Benevolent Association. Good to have you on our program.
Thank you very much, sir.
What do you say to what we have just heard, and does it, in fact, end up putting a kind of burden on the police?
Well, it does. I question, there's a lot of talk about what happens in Washington. We don't have that experience here in Cleveland. If you're indigent and it's some type of minor infraction, community services offered, you know, go out and pick garbage up on the side of the street for, you know, as a punishment to whatever the crime is. I don't know, you know, I'm not talking specifically about any one crime, but minor crimes. If you're indigent and you can't pay, the court systems are very cognizant of that here in Cuyahoga County and the City of Cleveland Municipal Courts, and they make every arrangement that they can to ensure that it's as easy as possible for you to pay the fine or, you know, do whatever it is that the judge needs you to do to, you know, pay for the crime that was committed. You know, so I don't know what a good punishment for poor people is that commit crimes. You know, we can't just ignore that. I don't agree with, you know, some of those things. Some folks choose jail over paying a fine. Many fines, in my experience here in Cleveland, are held in abeyance. You know, if you complete your probation appropriately. By probation means you have to go and meet with the probation officer, whatever the probation rules were set with the judge, and oftentimes that's enough to commute the fine here. So we don't have the same experience in Cleveland and in Ohio. I think that.
Well, what about what we just heard about Ferguson and Baltimore and Milwaukee? Ms. Harris, Professor Harris, suggests, and certainly the investigation of the situation in Baltimore indicated that this is certainly going on there.
Well, what is this? You know, people are committing crimes. They're being.
Well, this is the inflation in fees that she referred to, which, when people can't pay in those cities, not only puts them into debt, but often puts them into jail.
Yeah, well, if it puts them into jail, then the fine is gone. You know, so I don't know, without talking specifically case by case, what goes on in these other states. I'm not educated in that, but I can tell you that. You know, the African-American judges here in Cleveland, majority African-American municipal judges, you know, there's a lot of community input here as to how things should work. We have a very liberal set of circumstances here in Cleveland, and the judges go, you know, above and beyond where they need to go to get those fines taken care of. It's definite, I can tell you this. It is absolutely not a cash cow or a cash revenue resource here in Cleveland, anyhow. You know, it may be somewhere else, but it's not here in Cleveland for sure.
Let me go back to Professor Harris. Would you call this a cash cow for other cities?
Well, this is the big question, is that no one has yet done a good cost-benefit analysis to see the extent to which local jurisdictions are generating profit from this. Surely, when I did the research in Washington, a lot of policymakers and practitioners, particularly the clerks, would say that this is a good revenue stream, but no one could show us the accounting to say that, yes, this is making money. And I do want to make a point that your other speaker or guest has a good point in noting that there's a great deal of variation in how this process works across local jurisdictions, municipal, and then also superior courts. We don't know the extent to which this is happening in every jurisdiction across the nation, but we do know what's happening, and we know what's happening in Ohio. Just when your presiding justice of the Ohio State Supreme Court, Maureen O'Connor, created as one of the leader in the nation on creating a bench card to help inform judges in Ohio of what the law is. So this is happening in Ohio, and it's happening in every state. It may not be happening in your county, and there are some great counties that can be role models for other jurisdictions, but it's clearly happening in many other cities and state superior courts nationwide.
I should say that in the county of Los Angeles, the Superior Court is being sued en masse by people who say that this is not only going on, but that judges here are, in fact, ignoring state law, which requires that they find out whether people can, in fact, pay or whether they're not paying because they're being simply truants and scoff laws. And the court is being sued for not attempting to make that distinction. Myron Orfield is with us, professor of civil rights law at the University of Minnesota Law School, a student of a widely cited study, called America's Racially Diverse Suburbs, Opportunities and Challenges. Myron Orfield, welcome to you.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
What about the national picture?
Well, I think one of the things that's happening is you have a lot of communities that are undergoing racial change or have undergone racial change in their suburbs, like Ferguson. And they had a lot of police profiling before, or a lot of police stops before, and then, and partly this is the structure of racial segregation and housing discrimination and the way that police in white communities treat people of color that are close by. But then when communities often undergo this racial transformation, like Ferguson did, they lose all their tax base, and they get totally broke. And so you know, this kind of behavior is even more encouraged because it's one of the only ways to get money. Poor black suburbs that are majority black, are the poorest places in the United States in terms of tax base. They just don't have much to tax. And when that happens, I think they're aggressively looking for any form of revenue. They have limits on how high they can tax their homeowners, too, because their homeowners, a lot of them have already left and could leave. So you can impose fines and fees on places like Ferguson, but they're basically broke. And in states like Missouri, you don't have the state intervening to help pay for the cost of schools. You don't have anything like tax sharing or any support for the municipal government. And so that creates a lot of pressure on these communities to do stuff like that.
What does it do to people's attitude toward the police?
Well, I think police profiling in general, which is pervasive in segregated metropolitan areas, period, I think that's a bad thing. And I think if people realize that it's becoming a revenue source, it's got to certainly make those feelings worse. You know, I think, you know, part of this is just the police are stopping black men a lot, particularly when they're driving through adjacent whiter communities. Or for other reasons, even in poor segregated neighborhoods, that's a problem. But when it becomes one of the ways that cities and courts are deriving their own revenues, then it becomes easier to resent that behavior. There's more than one reason to resent that.
And are there statistics on that, that it's a widespread problem, that African Americans in particular are stopped more often than whites?
Yeah, no, very, very widespread phenomenon, and it's particularly prevalent in places that are very racially segregated.
Okay. Stephen Livis, back to you with the Cleveland Patrolmen's Benevolent Association. Is that a problem? Is that an issue in Cleveland? We know there have been cases reported there and widely circulated around the country.
Well, we had the University of Cincinnati came in and did a study on racial profiling during traffic stops. And we literally had to fill out another traffic ticket. It was anonymous in nature, but it had all the information that the college needed for its study, and at the end of a year and a half long gathering of information, they came back with an inconclusive conclusion. You know, so I'm not saying that these folks are wrong or that you know, there's lies, damn lies, and statistics out there, but the excuse me. That's not the experience that we have here in Cleveland. And I'll tell you, we had traffic camera, you know, red light cameras, speed cameras. They put 60 of these things up in the city of Cleveland. And that right there is nothing but a revenue stream, and it's a tax without representation on the citizens of this city and the visitors of this city. And what we did as a union, that represented about a $6.8 million source of revenue for the city, but it was wrong. And we and the police officers voted. We voted to assist the citizen groups in getting that put on the ballot, and we voted those things out of here. We booed them out of here. So, you know, that was absolutely wrong. When police officers are sent down into the neighborhoods, you know, again, lies, damn lies, and statistics. I can sit here and talk statistics all day long. You know, 52% of the homicides in the United States of America are completed by 6% of the population, which is African-American males between 15 and 35 years old. That's not a nice number.
Very, very quickly, though, I'm sorry, we're getting into a different issue. What about the traffic cams? Why are they problematic?
Well, because they're problematic on a bunch of different levels, but it takes away the discretion of the police officer. If I catch you fair and square going through a red light, you may have a very good reason for that. Your wife may be having a baby in the backseat of the car or, you know, something else. And we have discretion as to whether we're going to give you a ticket or not on that. It absolutely takes away the discretion. And there's the only way that you can fight those things, if your wife was having a baby in the car, would be to take a day off of work and go to an apartheid hearing, is what they call them here, and make your argument in front of a court-appointed magistrate, and very oftentimes you lost.
Okay, please hold that thought, because we need to go to a break. On our talking point letter, the Jewish con man who hustled Hitler. Back in a moment with To the Point from PRI.
Subscribe to KCRW's Today's Top Tune Download podcast. To receive a free song of the day, find today's top tune on KCRW's iTunes page.
Warren Olney back with To the Point. Talking today about the increase in fees and fines for minor violations and how they're being used by cities around the country, according to some researchers. Earlier on our program, we heard from Alexis Harris. She's author of Pound of Flesh, about how this can lead to a cycle of debt. A small penalty grows with interest, gets compounded by a collection fee, and if that's unpaid, it can lead to an arrest warrant. That produces revenue that's replacing what local governments throughout the country are not getting through the usual kinds of taxation. It's a system of backdoor municipal finance, and it's not just about money. It leads to more anger and resentment between minority communities and the local police. Lester Spence is an associate professor of political science at Johns Hopkins University in Baltimore. He specializes in the study of black, racial, and urban politics. Professor Spence, thanks for being on our program.
Oh, thank you for having me.
There was a scathing report about Baltimore and in the aftermath of the police shootings there. Where do you come down on this issue of the use of minor or fines and fees for minor offenses as a source of revenue, which particularly puts a burden on blacks and other minorities?
Well, first, I think that the problem is a significant one, but that problem tends to be concentrated in smaller areas with high black populations. In fact, there's some good research that suggests it's not necessarily the poverty level of the municipality, but the black population. And most of the cities, I'm looking at a website now, PriceEconomics.com, that actually has a really good set of tables on this. Most of the cities that really, really, really use fines to garner, extort revenue from folk are like small suburbs. So when you look at Baltimore, and I read the DOJ report, I think Baltimore gets less than 5% of its revenue from policing. Chicago, which is another city that has a police issue, less than 5%. Detroit, by way of comparison, I think is less than 5%. It might even be like 2%. So what you see in those cities, and it's not as if those cities are good examples in which we have policing done right, but what you really see in those cities, instead of an attempt to kind of garner, extort revenue, is really a means of kind of social control. To the extent that there's any revenue garnered from policing those folk, it's really money that goes to the police department, right? So Baltimore spends approximately $500 million on policing, largely just to as a tactic of social control for poor black populations.
Elaborate on what you mean by social control.
Oh, well, so if you think about New York, when New York kind of innovates with broken windows policing, and what they believe is that they can reduce crime by basically arresting people for a range of minor things, the ticky-tack stuff that the sister talked about earlier, that dynamic ends up making them end up really courting them. It ends up policing them just for being. Right. So it's not the goal isn't to extort revenue from them. The goal is to make them act in a certain way. And if they can't act in a certain way, then they're heavily policed. That's what I mean by social control.
OK. And you mentioned Detroit, but isn't it primarily a African-American city now?
Yes, but it's important to understand, and this is something that the brother from Cleveland implied, that what we're talking about is not necessarily a racial dynamic, right? So we're talking about a race and class dynamic. So as bad as the Baltimore Department of Justice report was, it's important to note that Baltimore's mayor is African-American.
And in fact, if you look at the increase in police spending over time, most of that, a lot of that increase have come over the past three mayors. They've all been, or two out of three of them have been black. The president of the city council is black, and a majority of the city council members are black. So this is not just a racial thing, but it's a race and class thing. So when we talk, whether we're talking about extorting revenue from citizens, or if we're talking about using police as a form of social control, we're talking about policing as a mechanism that's primarily used to deal with black and working class, the poor residents, not solely black residents.
Back to Stephen Loomis with the Cleveland Patrolmen's Benevolent Association. What do you say to that argument that this is really a means of social control, particularly when it comes to blacks?
What do you say to that argument? You know, it's an opinion. I'm out there with the guys every day. I deal with police officers. I go to community meetings on a regular basis. The people that call us, you know, I've been a police officer 23 years. I've never, thousands of radio calls for service. I've never one time called the dispatcher back and said, hey, what color is the family that's calling me? And better than that, I've never one time gone to one of those calls and had somebody come out and size me up and go, send me a black cop. Those are other people's agendas and other people's issues. The package that we come in and the package that are, of the people that are calling us does not matter to those particular groups. Baltimore also is a majority minority police department as well. You know, so the gentleman was saying a black mayor, black prosecutors, black judges, majority black judges. It is a majority minority police department as well, and they've done a very good job with minority
Professor Orfield, let me go back to you. Pardon me. If we have social control, who's trying to control who?
In terms of the police trying to control African-American people or people of different classes? Well, I mean, one of the things that happens, I think, that police officers are supposed to do is you have areas of great segregation caused by housing discrimination that become very poor, and they often have high crime rates. And one of the things that the society says is lower those crime rates, and they send police in to be very, very, very active in those places. And then they're ending up trying to keep crime rates down or do something to have an impact on those statistics, which tend to be higher in those poor neighborhoods. I think it has the effect in these poor neighborhoods that are pretty desperate places a lot of times, with terrible schools, without economic opportunities, of feeling, you're being controlled. The schools are bad, the neighborhoods are poor, there's nothing happening, and there's people stopping you all the time and looking to see whether you might be committing a crime because the numbers are there. And I think that's got to be a demoralizing thing, especially given all the other aspects of living in a poor, segregated neighborhood.
Again, Myron Orfield is at the University of Minnesota, and he's author of America's Racially Diverse Suburbs, Opportunities and Challenges. So you would agree, I take it, with Professor Spence that this is an issue. You talked about transitional areas, small suburbs rather than big cities.
Yeah, no, I think the suburbs are where you have these big problems, and you have a combination of things. First of all, when you have a black neighborhood next to a white suburban neighborhood or a black suburb next to a white suburb, you have a lot of tension. And a lot of times, the police, whether consciously or unconsciously, whether directly ordered or whether following some sense of what they feel like they have to do, they're trying to control that racial borderline. And they're trying to make sure that it doesn't change in some way, or doing their part in that. So then there's a culture of stopping a lot of people in those kinds of borderline places. And then when a suburb goes through racial transition, as most of them do, when the white suburb next to the black suburb begins to change and resegregates, it loses all of its money, just like the black suburb did before. And then suddenly you have usually an older white city council and an older white police force in a black suburb, and no money, and the incentives to do these kinds of endless stopping and controlling issues go up, and they have actual fiscal motivation in these places. Okay. These suburbs get really poor. I mean, when you have a post-World War II suburb that's built of sort of not very nice houses, that were built not to last very long, it doesn't have a significant commercial or industrial base or anything to remediate, they get really poor.
So, Lester Spencer, I want to go back to you in Baltimore. You're the one who used the term social control. What about social control in a city like Baltimore, where the officialdom and the police itself, police department itself, are so very largely African American? Let me ask you the same question. Who's trying to control who?
Well, so what we have is a system of control that really is targeted at poor black populations. So that DOJ report, 44% of their stops, and there were approximately 300,000 recorded stops within a 5 or 6 year period, I think, and then there were 700,000 stops that probably were under-recorded, right, or were unrecorded. Most of those were concentrated in the Western District and in the Central District. Central District is the business district. Western District includes the neighborhood that Freddie Gray was killed in. That area, you've got people in that area. You've got one guy, the DOJ report, a guy who was stopped 34 times by police, and in no circumstance was he even issued a citation. Is that it's like he stopped just for living.
Well, is that the result of policies being implemented by, as set out and being implemented by African Americans who control the city?
Right. So in that case, what you have is a bleed over. So in the early in the mid to late 90s, when Mayor O'Malley was elected, Mayor Martin O'Malley instituted zero tolerance policing. And then that zero tolerance led to hundreds of thousands of arrests. Many of them got thrown out in court. And then what happens is Sheila Dixon, an African-American mayor, she explicitly stopped that practice, but that practice still continued implicitly, and police were still incentivized to make stops, both by their superiors and then within the general culture. So what you have is kind of a dynamic in which you have some pushback from African Americans, from African American political officials, and definitely pushback from a number of black activists. But at the same time, as the Cleveland brother noted, there are some African Americans themselves who actually prefer tactics of social control used against poor black populations.
Okay. Let me go back to Alexis Harris, our very first guest on the first part of our program, associate professor of sociology at the University of Washington, author of A Pound of Flesh. She was the first one who talked about the use of these low-level crimes, fines, and fees that escalate. Tell us, if you will, about examples of what you refer to as a sort of rhetoric that's used by lawmakers and by prosecutors to justify what you regard as very burdensome levies, others of on our program regard it as well, levies on the poor.
Right. I mean, I think it's really more instructful to, in a way, put race on the back burner, because I hear people sort of shutting down and getting a lot of tension when we start talking about race and you asking these questions about black people being the people who are implementing this policy. But if we step back and analyze the system, the criminal justice system, and what it's doing is that we have these policies that are being set by politicians in their state legislatures, and they have this rhetoric, and the rhetoric is twofold. One, it's that we need to generate resources because we can no longer fund mass conviction and incarceration. We need to figure out where we can get more money because we're doing this and sort of too many people are coming through our system. So it does make logical sense that if people are coming through our system, we should fine them. We should sentence them to debt, and they should pay it. The problem with that rhetoric is that no one's doing the accounting. No one's open. If you go to any clerk, and mostly clerks run these processes across jurisdictions across the nation, no clerk can show an analysis that they've done to say, hey, this is cost effective, that people are paying, right? Instead, we see in Washington, millions and millions of dollars of people being in debt. Average payments of people across Washington state, when the average debt for felony conviction is around $1,300, people are paying $112 a year towards that debt. That's with 12% interest. So there's this rhetoric around cost that's it's sort of generating revenue and it doesn't pan out. And there's also this odd rhetoric around accountability. The people I interviewed in Washington are saying that these people need to be held accountable for what they're doing. And in addition to going to jail, because in Washington it's not either or, they're doing both. So in addition to going to jail and to prison, we're going to sentence you to fiscal amounts. And there's this paternalistic sense that this is creating a system that allows individuals to show remorse via each payment. So in some minds of the politicians and policymakers that I interviewed, they said it's not about them ever paying this off, but it's about them showing remorse, them being held accountable and making these regularly monthly payments. But I think if we step back and look at what the system is doing, let's not talk about black police officers, let's not talk about, just for the moment, black people being disproportionately having contact with the criminal justice system, but we see literally a two-tiered system of justice. And it's designed from policy that poor people receive a different experience and will be tethered for a much longer time, possibly for the rest of their lives, to the criminal justice system because of their poverty.
But you're talking about poverty rather than just race. In other words, this goes across race. Lines and perhaps there are more poor people who are white in this country than there are poor people who are black.
Well, it's complicated, yes, because we have a disproportionate number of people of color, and it's not just African Americans, it's Latinos and Native Americans and some South Pacific Island Asians as well. But because they're disproportionately poor, it disproportionately affects them. But this also affects poor whites. I mean, I've had tons of parents and people email me who are white who are affected by the system as well.
Okay, I'm going to have to end it at this point. Again, Alexis Harris at the University of Washington. Many thanks to you. Stephen Loomis at the Cleveland Patrolman's Benevolent Association. Lester Spence at Johns Hopkins in Baltimore, Marvin Orfield in Minnesota. In a moment, Mae West, Adolf Hitler, and a Jewish con man. It's not the setup for a joke. It's a family memoir by our next guest. Back in a moment with To the Point from PRI.
Check out KCRW's music blog for song premieres, music news, performances, and KCRW DJ features. Stay up to date on all of KCRW's music happenings at kcrw.com/musicblog.
I'm Warren Olney, and this is today's Talking Point. Hustling Hitler is subtitled The Jewish Vaudevillian Who Fooled the Führer. That's accurate as far as it goes. But when he died, the obituary in Variety described Freeman Bernstein as a con man with a heart of gold. He was much more than a vaudevillian. That's according to Walter Shapiro, Bernstein's nephew, now writing about his ninth presidential campaign for Roll Call, and a familiar voice on To the Point. He's also the author of Hustling Hitler, and he's sitting here with me in the studio.
Warren, it's such a pleasure to be here and talking about the book.
Did this Jewish vaudevillian con man really meet Hitler in the 30s, when it had already become law in Germany that Jews were subhuman?
Well, my great uncle, as near as I can tell, did go to Germany in late 1935. Freeman wrote a book after he did scam the Nazis on a nickel deal entitled Was Hitler's Nickel Hijacked?, in which he claimed the cargo was switched on the high seas.
Okay. We won't go into the nickel. I don't want to reveal for our listeners exactly what the con was about, but it did have to do with supplying Germany with military—
A vital war material, except they got scrap metal instead of high-grade Canadian nickel, and my great-uncle got the equivalent of $2 million.
Okay, so he was a flawless con, or some maybe not a flawless con.
The con did fall apart when he was arrested in Los Angeles at midnight in February 1937 in the back of his chauffeured limousine, leaving Mae West's apartment. And it was a grand he was a fugitive warrant from New York because he had been indicted for grand larceny, and as I discovered in trying to turn this family story into a book, if you can put Adolf Hitler and Mae West in the opening paragraph of your book proposal, and neither is a metaphor, you're probably in good shape.
Tell us about the picture of the guy in the white suit with the pith helmet and the cigar.
Okay. My father, who was a Connecticut city planner and was going to zoning board hearings in the evening, not exactly a flamboyant lifestyle, was always obsessed with his Uncle Freeman, who had been born in Troy, New York in the 1870s. And he would tell me stories about how he was big in vaudeville, how he was friends with Sophie Tucker and people like that, how he married a showgirl. But I never believed him. It was like him taking me aside and saying, you know, son, you're a direct descendant of Sitting Bull. impressive, but unlikely. But about a year before my father died, going through family papers, he came upon a picture of a rotund man in a white suit with a pith helmet sitting on the lawn of a guest house holding a cigar in his right hand. And the legend on the back indicated that this was from a paper in the colonial British era. It said, from the Times of Ceylon. And as I subsequently realized, on the lam in China, in Asia, where he had crowned himself the Jade King of China in an impressive investiture ceremony, a little like King Arthur and the Sword of the Stone, that he had been taken a picture of for the newspaper, prominent jade dealer in Ceylon. And this was the picture. I blew it up for my father, and it was on the wall of the place he was living when he died.
All right. So the guy in the white suit and the pith helmet, you learned about it or saw the picture of him in the Times of Ceylon, but most of the research for the book comes out of papers in Los Angeles.
A lot of it because there was a major Los Angeles extradition fight that after he was arrested, the Jewish community in Hollywood, including Al Jolson, who was very big in this, Mae West, Joseph Schenck, who was one of the founders of 20th Century Fox, put together a whole Freeman Bernstein support network and prevailed upon the governor at that time, Frank Merriam, not to extradite. The idea of not extraditing a standard felony warrant in America was just amazing.
And the warrant was issued in New York by Thomas Dewey at the request of the German government and the Führer, who were outraged because they didn't get their nickel.
Exactly. In fact, I have in the book, Hustling Hitler, pictures taken by one appropriately named Otto Reich of, instead of the nickel, he showed pictures on the docks in Hamburg of rusted tin cans and discarded Canadian auto bodies that they got instead of the nickel. In fact, my great uncle Freeman said afterwards, you know, if you melt it down, there's probably some nickel in there somewhere.
So at any rate, he didn't get extradited, largely for political reasons, apparently. It's amazing that Thomas Dewey would have allowed the indictment to go forward in the first place.
Well, this really surprised me. But one of the things in doing this book, I benefited from, the nice thing about being a grifter is law enforcement agencies tend to have a lot of interest in your activities. So I came up with 1,500 pages of government files from both the New York DA's office archives and the California archives just to allow me to describe this in great detail. But Freeman Bernstein was such a colorful figure, I also benefited from 2,500 newspaper clips, including just wonderful clips from Variety, where the editor of Variety, Syme Silverman, would refer to him as the pet of Broadway.
How did he get arrested in the first place? He was in the back of the limousine. How did they know? Why did they pick him up?
We don't know for sure. The L.A. police head of the fugitive squad gave a press conference the next day in which he claims this is the result of a six-month international manhunt. I personally think that one of his victims, the middleman in New York, hired private detectives to track him down. And Freeman Bernstein was about as hard to find as Lou Gehrig at first base at Yankee Stadium. I mean, he had already been in the L.A. Times in Palm Springs peddling jade. And at this point, he was not exactly staying in obscurity. Under his own name, he was at the Garden of Allah Hotel. So tracking him down was not one of these great moments. But the story I love is the L.A. Times visited him for a jailhouse interview after he had been in jail for a day. And as the unnamed reporter puts it, Mr. Bernstein requested a cigar. When he was told no cigar was available, he reluctantly took a cigarette. and blew a perfect smoke ring. Surgeon general or no surgeon general, I really love the idea of being related to somebody who had the savoir-faire to blow a perfect smoke ring after a day in jail.
That's the right time to do it, it would seem to me. He also tried to sell Mae West some diamonds.
Yeah, and Mae West devotes 4 pages in her autobiography to Freeman's way of, shall we say, mixing good jewels with bad and hoping that someone would not be able to tell a difference. Mae West, however, came equipped with her own jeweler's scale and a loop. But what she tells in the autobiography is how my great uncle smuggled jade and diamonds into the country. And it was a wonderful scheme that he had a little dog, a little terrier, and he fed the dog a mineral-rich diet about 3 hours out from port. And as they dock in wherever they dock on the West Coast, this distinguished gentleman would emerge with a flower in his buttonhole and the cutest little ball of white fluff on a leash. And what could be more benign than Freeman Bernstein and his dog Benji going through customs?
He managed to stay out of jail most of the time, and when he was in Ceylon, I take it, he was a fugitive.
Well, he did take off for the Orient because there was, it happens to anyone. There was the card game, there was the sports book in the Hotel New Yorker where he wrote the bum checks. Yeah. And then, of course, there was the Irish Festival under the name, which he organized in Boston under the name of Roger Orion. Mr. Bernstein, by the way, did not look like a Roger Orion. And it was a great success in Boston until Mr. Orion disappeared with the gate receipts. And the Boston papers had a wonderful time writing about Mr. Orionstein.
Well, now, Freeman Bernstein also had a con for a partner, a guy from Canada. And did he turn informant against Mayor Brenner?
Mayor Brenner. The second time, he was finally, Governor Frank Merriam finally extradited him on the bum check charges to New York in 1938, but with the stipulation that Freeman could not be tried for nicking Hitler in the nickel deal. So as I explained in Hustling Hitler, Freeman arrives in New York, spends one day in the Tombs, as the prison was, the jail was called, and says to the DA's office, I can help you get my collaborators across the border from Canada, and I will testify against them.
All right. We have been talking with the author of Hustling Hitler, Walter Shapiro, who claims all of this stuff is true and that he got it out of newspapers and government records as well. It's great to have you on our program.
Always a pleasure, Warren.
Well, that's it for this special Labor Day edition of To the Point. Our producers are Katie Cooper, Andrea Brody, Jenny Hamill, Paul Van Zielbauer, and Sasha Woodruff. Managing producer Evan George. Our technical director is Joel Stein. Happy Labor Day to everybody. I'm Armin Alney. Join us again for To the Point, a co-production of KCRW Santa Monica and Public Radio International.
Public Radio International.